Where Do Emotions Come From? A groundbreaking new book rejects conventional wisdom. There is a lot of information out there about the brain and how it functions. Perhaps you've seen the news stories comparing the differences between men's and women's brains, suggesting that we are hardwired to be different. Maybe you've read about a part of the brain called the amygdala and how it regulates emotions like fear. Or perhaps a kindly relative has looked at your newborn baby and exclaimed, "Oh, look at that smile, what a happy baby," insinuating that the baby is born knowing how to express human emotion. Well, now a renowned researcher tells us that much of what we believe about the human brain and emotions is wrong, that emotions aren't automatic or universal, but rather constructed. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, a discussion with psychologist and author Lisa Feldman Barrett. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. When Lisa Feldman Barrett was a graduate student more than 20 years ago, her experiment to study human emotions didn't go the way she expected. And that experience made her ask a fundamental question. What if emotions don't actually work the way everyone assumes? This question has driven her research over the past two decades. The findings in her latest book turn the conventional thinking about emotions on their head, so to speak. Today, we'll find out more about this revolutionary take on how emotions relate to the brain. Joining me from WGBH Studios in Boston is Lisa Feldman Barrett. She is the University Distinguished Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University, with appointments at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Her work encompasses several fields, including clinical and social psychology and cognitive science. She received an NIH Director's Pioneer Award for her research on emotions in the brain, and her most recent book just came out. It is called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you want to know about our emotions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Barrett, thanks so much for joining us today. Such an interesting topic.
Thanks so much for having me on your show, Jennifer.
And I'm going to do something really fun to begin the show. We've gone back to 1979 and pulled up a clip from Mork and Mindy. And for those in our audience who are a little younger, maybe don't remember Mork and Mindy, Robin Williams played Mork, who was an alien from the planet Ork sent here to study humans. And in this episode, he's learned about emotions, and his emotions have taken him on an adventure.
We start off by going to this really cheap dive called the ballpark. Fear didn't want to go in, but disgust called him a sissy. And excitement was so titillated by that, he went to the bar and ordered 10 beers, one for each finger. Guilt felt so bad about that, he yanked us into the alley. Whimsy said it must be named Mohammed. Shut up! Let me finish the story!
And it's a very silly clip, but, you know, it goes on, and it shows that Mork is being controlled by his emotions. And even though he's an alien, he's suddenly becoming a human. And I'm thinking that, Dr. Barrett, that even though it's humorous, this is not how you perceive of emotions.
No, not at all. In fact, it seems like an early version of Inside Out.
Oh, the movie, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that movie is really interesting, as is the clip, because it really embodies our general beliefs about emotion, that there's one little circuit inside of our brains for each emotion that, when it's triggered, leads us to do and say things that we would rather not, that's somewhat out of our control, and that there are stereotypic things we do. So when anger, when our switch is flipped, so to speak, We scowl and our heart rate goes up and we turn red and so on. So the assumption is that, you know, this happens to everybody in the world because emotions are baked into your brain at birth, basically. That's the general idea.
Yeah, your research has been compared to Darwin's, that it's a huge change in the way we understand ourselves. Can you explain what your findings say about emotions and what's so radically different than what we've thought for centuries?
Sure. So what we found, and many other scientists as well, is that You know, the human brain is basically a master of deception. It creates experiences of emotion and directs your actions in a way never revealing how it does so, and at the same time giving you a false sense of confidence that its products, your experiences, actually reveal the way it works. So for thousands of years, people have believed that individual emotions live in different parts of the brain. And what we find instead, using psychological methods and also the methods of modern neuroscience, is that when you feel happy or sad or angry or any other emotion, it's not because your brain is reacting to events in the world. In fact, your brain is predicting what's going to happen next. It's constantly guessing what's going to happen next using your past experience. And these guesses are the basis for your emotion. And this is happening entirely outside your awareness all the time. So you basically have a set of networks in your brain that are like ingredients, and they are constantly working together to make predictions about what's going to happen next using past experience. And when your brain uses past experiences of an emotion, then it's basically predicting and eventually constructing instances of emotion.
So we're perpetually constructing our idea of what an emotion is, whether it's happiness or sadness or something more specific, bliss or frustration, yet we're not really aware that we're doing that.
Exactly. Our emotions, like all of our perceptions and our memories and so on, are not built in waiting to be they're not built into the brain at birth, you know, waiting to be revealed by science. We make emotion on the fly as we need them, just in the same way that our brains construct perceptions and thoughts and beliefs and so on the spot as needed through a complex interplay of networks in the brain.
Why is your research so radical? Why, when you present this, do people sometimes become very angry and agitated? What is it in the scientific world that you're turning on its head that makes people uncomfortable?
I don't know. I'll take a guess. I think in part, so first of all, not everyone gets riled up. Some people, many people actually in the scientific community find this to make a lot of sense, because it's what I'm proposing here is very consistent with what we know about how the brain is structured and how it functions and so on. But when people get upset, I think because it's violating a very deeply held belief that we've had really since the time of Plato, since ancient Greece, that we have, that we have sort of emotions that are buried deep within the animal parts of ourselves that have to be controlled by our highly evolved brains. And the idea that this is not the case really violates one of the most cherished views of human nature in Western civilization.
It kind of challenges what it means to be human.
It does indeed. And in fact, you know, when I first thought about writing this book and I approached an editor, the book that they wanted me to write went something like this. You know, once upon a time, we believed the classical view of emotion was true. Modern neuroscience in the last 20 years has debunked it. The end. But the truth is, the story really is that since the time, since ancient Greece and in ancient Egypt, people have been proposing some version of the classical view, the idea that you are, you know, an animal wrapped in rationality. And ever since that time, people have been pointing out evidence that doesn't fit with that idea, whatever the evidence of the time happened to be. And so you have to ask, and as I do in the book, why would a theory persist through millennia, really, when in every age there have been critics and evidence that it's not really true? And I think the answer, or that at least it's highly in doubt, and I think the answer is that it's a cherished view of human nature that we just don't want to give up. It's embedded in the way we deal with each other. It's embedded in the law. It's embedded in all sorts of, it lurks in all sorts of places in our culture.
Do people say to you, Lisa Feldman Barrett, you are saying that emotions are constructed and also that they are not universal. So then how come people around the world smile at each other in greeting, in friendliness?
Well, I first ask the question, why is it the case that there was no word for smile in ancient Greek and ancient Roman? And why is there no evidence of people smiling until the advent of dentistry in the 18th century? So I think the first question we have to ask is really, when did smiling become a universal greeting? I don't think that I think the smile may be one of the facial movements that we make that is more or less universal at this point. And I think we can start asking questions about why that is the case. But I don't think it's universal because we have a happiness circuit built into the brain, which triggers a smile. In fact, there's no evidence that there is such a circuit that anyone's ever been able to find using any method in neuroscience. And in fact, smiles often mean many other things. People smile when they're angry, and they smile when they're embarrassed. They smile for all sorts of reasons that have nothing to do with happiness. And also, people can be very happy and not smile at all. So the observation here is that happiness is a population of very unique instances, of highly variable instances. People don't always smile when they're angry, smile when they're happy, and they're not always happy when they're smiling.
How do you define emotions? Is it just a matter of word? We have emotions because we have words for them?
Well, you're asking how do I define emotion in a scientific sense, or how do I understand what they are in everyday life? I'm not sure about your question.
Well, I guess I'm asking a broader question. What is an emotion anyway?
Ah, okay. Well, here's the way I think about it based on my understanding and the evidence. Every waking moment of your life, your brain is anticipating sensory inputs from the world and sensory inputs from your body, and it's trying to make sense of them. If you don't have prior knowledge of these sensory inputs, you won't experience them. So if you, for example, are hearing a language that you've never heard before, to you it will sound like a bunch of noise. When I'm listening to dubstep, you know, to me it sounds like a bunch of noise. I don't have a concept. Well, I actually am gaining a concept for dubstep thanks to my daughter. I have these images that I use sometimes. There's one in the book, and I sometimes use these in talks where I'll show people a set of blobby black and white blobs, and I ask people what they see, and they see nothing except black and white blobs, usually. And then I show them the photograph on which the blobs were made, and all of a sudden they see an object in the blobs they've never seen before, and they really can't unsee it. And to me, this is a really good example of how the brain is imposing meaning on sensory inputs. And so sometimes when the brain is using past experience, it's making sense of your what's going on inside your body in relation to the world as an emotion. So emotions are not your reactions to the world. They are your constructions of the world.
I want to ask you about some ideas that have made it into the news in the last decade or so. One, and this is one I have heard repeated by friends and seen in newspapers, is that men and women's brains are wired differently. That it's almost a given in conversation today. Is that true?
That is pretty much an overstatement. There's a lot packed into that, which I think we can object to. And there's a fantastic book, actually, by a woman named Cornelia Fine, where she takes this on, you know, quite directly, and she does a very nice job with it. Here's what I'll say. My brain and your brain vary from one another. All brains, if you sort of take off your glasses and squint, look the same, right? They all have kind of the same macro structure, but they vary tremendously in terms of their microstructure. And this some of this variability is meaningful, but some of it doesn't seem to translate into anything that we can see or experience or measure. So male and female brains on average don't seem to vary in ways that make much difference for emotions, for example. They don't seem to make the ways that they might vary don't seem to make much difference for the ability to be self-controlled, the ability to do math, or the ability to reason, or any of these things. And I think that's really the important point. I think also what's slightly complicated about this question is that women's brains actually change throughout the cycle, throughout the menstrual cycle of the month, throughout the cycle of the month. That's, you know, a recent discovery that has really important implications for understanding women's health, actually.
It seems as though there are a lot of elements of your research and your findings that have implications throughout our society. And one that struck me is in the court system, that you use the example of Dakar Tsarnaev and not showing remorse for the bombings in Boston. And we hear that often in court cases, that there's some sort of, the judge is looking at the defendant and saying, is this defendant expressing remorse? And you kind of have a problem with that, that maybe isn't the right way to be approaching sentencing.
Well, I think it's important to understand that the legal system in the United States and in other countries as well really embody the classical view of emotion. The laws, as they are written, make certain assumptions about emotion. And one of the assumptions that they make is that you should be able to look at someone and know their heart and mind. So, for example, in a court case in 1992, Supreme Court Justice Kennedy basically made the argument that it's impossible to get a fair trial unless jurors and judges can know the heart and the mind of the offender in order to judge that offender properly and sentence that offender. And so the assumption is that you know, in order to get a fair trial, you need to be able to look at someone and know what they're feeling. And the Tsarnaev case, I think, is really interesting. And I just want to preface what I'm about to say by saying that I am not making a moral judgment and I am not making a political statement. I'm just speaking now as a scientist. What was interesting to me is that, you know, he was raised in a culture where remorse was, and in fact, most emotions were not expressed overtly on the face. So he was not from a culture that expressed remorse in a way that Americans do. And I was really interested, as I was following, as many people in Boston were, the court case. I should point out that the bombings, you know, happened a mile from my office. So we were, you know, personally felt very connected to the case and wanted to know what was happening. But there was also, you know, I was watching it with a scientist's eye and realizing that there was no way to know from his stoic stance whether he was remorseful or not, because in Chechen culture, there's this concept of the Chechen wolf. In defeat, you don't show any emotion at all. You remain stoic. That is the appropriate thing to do. And it turns out that, you know, he had written letters that indicated that he did feel remorseful. Nonetheless, he was sentenced to the death penalty, with the death penalty, because jurors thought that he wasn't remorseful. And no one brought up, even his lawyers, didn't raise the question of whether there was a cultural issue here.
Interesting. We're talking with Lisa Feldman Barrett. Her new book is How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. It is groundbreaking work on emotions and the brain. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Nellie Mae Education Foundation, supporting the Maine Education Project, and Raise Your Voice on MainePublic.org.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll visit a safe house where refugees from all over the world are waiting for asylum.
I got beaten up so many times. I got arrested so many times. But I soldiered on because I believed in my cause. And what I thought was, Mugabe won't kill me, but I was wrong.
One Refugee's Story, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Join us a Saturday afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Television has four channels. In addition to our main channel, we also offer World and Create and our new PBS Kids channel. World explores our world through many of your favorite programs such as the News Hour and Nova at different, perhaps more convenient times of the day. Create is our how-to channel, from cooking to carpentry to travel and then some. And the new PBS Kids is 24/7 educational safe kids programming with a companion streaming service with videos and games for your mobile device. If you'd like more information about World, Create, or PBS Kids, including how to find them, see your experience member guide. Visit mainpublic.org and click on television or call Maine Public Audience Services. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Human Emotions and How They Relate to the Brain. Joining me from a studio in Boston, Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a renowned psychologist based at Northeastern University. Her latest book is called How Emotions Are Made. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we get to the listener calls, though, I have to just ask you a couple questions, Lisa, that I have a feeling everyone wants to know. Have you done research into whether animals feel emotion as humans do? I suspect most dog and cat owners, for example, would say, yes, of course they do.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I have a chapter in the book where I deal with the question of animal emotions or whether animals have emotions. I should say, though, that I don't think this is not really a question that science can answer. It's really a question that's stipulated, you know. It really comes down to how you want to interpret the data and what inferences that you want to make. So what I would say is the available research, I personally don't do research with animals. I am a pet owner. I have, for example, I discuss in the book this example of my daughter has for many years had a whole herd of guinea pigs living in our house. And, you know, I'm like any pet owner as a mom and a pet owner. You know, there were these guinea pigs who, there was one guinea pig in particular. Her name was Cupcake. And I swear that she loved me. We were attached. I felt like she called to me every day, specifically to me. But as a scientist, what I can tell you is that there are circuits in our brain for freezing and running and fainting and attacking and so on. And to some extent, those circuits look somewhat similar across mammals. And if you define fear as freezing, then when you study that freezing circuit, you, I guess, are studying the circuit for fear. That's the way that some scientists have framed their work for a really long time. But from my perspective, you know, even rats do many things in a threatening situation. Sometimes they run, for sure, but sometimes they freeze and sometimes they attack and sometimes they do nothing at all. Similarly, you know, we do many things in fear. We certainly can freeze in fear, but we also laugh in the face of fear. We hide in fear. We gasp in fear. You know, we do many different things in fear. So from my perspective, I think animals that are not non-human animals have what we share with them is the capacity to have simple feelings of pleasantness, unpleasantness, to feel really worked up and aroused or really calm. I think that if you just look at the circuitry, it seems obvious that animals, at least obvious to me, that animals can feel pleasure and pain. But whether they feel human-like emotions of anger and awe and gratitude and guilt, I think I don't think there's a lot of evidence that they have the circuitry to make those emotions. I do, however, think that we see emotions in them the way we see emotions in plants and our cars and, you know, the way kids see emotions in their blankets and so on.
Who looks sad when you leave the house or dances with joy when you come home?
Yeah, so dogs can feel pleasure and pain. And they, dogs, we've bred dogs to be very attached to us. But let me give you an example. For years and years, people have interpreted dog behavior, the growling behavior or certain types of behavior as being dominance displays, when in fact it's been more recently discovered that dogs, when they look like they're doing a dominance display, are actually showing attachment behavior. They're anxious. So when they misbehave and don't do what you ask them to do, it's usually because they're having attachment anxiety. They're having separation anxiety. They're not trying to assert their dominance. This has been a persistent misunderstanding in dog behavior for decades now. So I think there are really nice studies showing that dogs are supremely sensitive to small movements in their owners' bodies. They're really sensitive to small changes. And they will show what looks like to a human looks like guilt when an owner is harsh with them, even when they haven't done anything wrong at all.
Mm. And the second thing I really wanted to ask you before we got to our listener calls and questions is that the whole idea of stress, how does stress affect? Because modern life is so stressful, and with screens and phone calls and emails and the constants of life today, how does that affect our brain circuitry and how we process emotions?
Well, stress is, I agree with you. I think stress is, our nervous systems evolved to deal with periodic bouts of big stress. What our nervous systems did not evolve to do is deal with the slow trickle of constant stress all the time, kind of death by a thousand cuts. That is really hard for a human nervous system to deal with. And in fact, we sort of have an ecosystem of stress that we've created for ourselves. We often don't sleep enough. We often don't eat in a way that gives us constant nutrients and energy to our bodies. We often don't exercise enough. And we are spend too much time, on social media in a context that involves sort of ambiguous social evaluation, which is probably hardest on a human nervous system. And so this really throws your nervous system out of whack. It throws your body out of whack. Your body's systems become unbalanced. And what you feel that as, unpleasantness, you feel it as discomfort, you feel it crappy, basically. And this becomes an ingredient for you to create negative emotion with.
We're going to go to the calls now. We're going to start with Tyler, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Tyler. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Tyler, are you there? Tyler, Bangor?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. My question was, in a theoretical instance, I guess, if a child was never exposed to the emotions that we perceive as negative, like violence or anger or frustration, if they were never revealed to that through like parents or other people in their lives or social media, anything, if somehow they were just sheltered from that from a young age and never experienced them, would those emotions never manifest at any point in their life based on what your research has shown?
So, Tyler, you're asking a fantastic question. And the answer is, regardless of what you've been exposed to in your life, every human comes prepared to feel pleasure and pain. We come prepared to feel pleasant and unpleasant. So an infant or a child who's never been exposed, say, to the concept of sadness will still have the capacity to feel discomfort and distress. But the question is whether or not the child will feel specifically sadness in the way that, we feel it, right? And I think what we know, really beyond a doubt, is that the evidence shows us that the infant brain doesn't look like an adult human brain. It's really awaiting a set of wiring instructions. It's waiting for the environment to tell it how to wire itself. infant brains wire themselves to the social and physical realities of their surroundings. So when you have a child who's never been exposed, let's say, to the concept of anger, I mean, the concept of sadness, no one's used that word. No, they've never seen anybody be sad. They won't construct, their brains are not equipped, essentially, to construct sadness out of their discomfort or their distress. You have to have knowledge about an emotion in order to experience it. So they might experience something other than sadness. And there are cultures, for example, where when you know, someone loses something significant to them at a time when we would feel we would be constructing sadness, they construct a different experience, an experience of feeling sick.
Thanks for your call, Tyler. We're going to move to Waterville in Ellery. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. Mrs. Rooks, an excellent program as usual. I have 1,000 questions, but I'd like to start with a simple one. I've often heard that when one forces a smile for whatever reason, it actually will cause an inner reaction or result in the brain of actually feeling an emotion. Now, is that actually documentable, or is that such a, or is it an anecdotal evidence?
Ellery, I've read the same thing. Dr. Barrett?
So the answer, Ellery, is one that psychologists like to give, which is, it depends. So there are experiments which have demonstrated that having people put their faces into, make the muscle movements of smiling without actually asking them overtly to smile, will in fact make them feel more pleasant. But there are probably just as many experiments which have failed to replicate that finding. Typically, when something like this happens, scientists start to debate over whether or not it's a real finding. And I think it is probably a real phenomenon, which happens sometimes. And the reason why I say this is that if you look at the structure of the brain, I mean, it feels to us as if we perceive things in the world and then we react to them and move our bodies or faces, right? So it seems to us like you would have to see something pleasant in order to smile. But in fact, because your brain is constantly predicting, what it's doing actually is preparing, based on past experience, it's making a prediction about what's about to happen next, and it starts to prepare your actions and that actually dictates what you see and what you hear. So there's this really intimate relationship between seeing and acting and feeling in the brain that sometimes the order of things doesn't really necessarily go in the expected order. And there are many cases where people will start to perform an action which then affects their feeling.
Ellery, thanks.
As opposed to the other way around.
Thanks for your question. I'm like you. I have a whole bunch, but we'll have to limit it to one for you right now. We have an email from Michelle. I'm curious to hear what Dr. Barrett thinks about people who have mood disorders and can't control or understand their emotions. Are medications such as mood stabilizers a solution?
That's a fantastic question that Michelle is asking, and it's a very complex question. So I'll try to just give two points that might be helpful. One is that many people who suffer from depression and other type of mood disorders have an impoverished vocabulary for emotion. They, not everybody, but some people have what's called alexithymia. They don't know that much about emotion. They don't have many concepts for emotion. And it turns out that when you peer into the brain, it turns out that concepts for emotion and other types of concepts, actually, the regions of the brain which initiate the construction or the use of these concepts for constructing experience are the same regions that control your body. They control your autonomic nervous system, your heart rate, your breathing rate. They control your immune system. They control your metabolism. So as your brain is attempting to construct concepts as predictions to construct your feelings, it's also regulating your body. If you don't have a lot of concepts that you can call on from past experience, you just have fewer tools to regulate your body. So this is one of the reasons why psychotherapies often involve helping people to learn more concepts about emotion. It's also why there's a fantastic program of training, expanding emotion vocabulary in school-age children, which not only improves their ability to regulate their own behavior, but it also improves their academic performance. They're less stressed in the classroom because they have these additional tools to help with self-regulation. But depression, in particular, also has another element to it, which is that so there's a part of the predictive process in a depressed brain that isn't quite working the way that it should. So when a neurotypical brain makes predictions, it's sort of like a scientist making hypotheses. The brain is kind of guessing at what's going to happen next, and then it uses the input from the world and from the body that eventually arrives to either confirm or correct its predictions. So, for example, if I asked Michelle to imagine, or ask your listeners now to imagine in their mind's eye, conjure a red Macintosh apple of the sort that you would eat, many people can see the ghost of a red apple in their mind's eye. And if I describe the apple and ask you to smell its, sweet fragrance, or take a bite into it and taste the tart sweetness, and so on, many people can conjure these experiences. If I were to pull out a real apple and show it to you, maybe the apple is slightly sweeter than the one that you just imagined. In which case, your brain would either correct its prediction, experience of sweetness, or it might just ignore the additional sweetness and not take it in. A depressed brain basically ignores that prediction error. It's a depressed brain is like a locked in brain. The brain is just—it's locked into the experiences are being driven by the past, but not being corrected by the present. And this is not something that just learning more emotion words is going to help. This is a more serious imbalance that has to be corrected in some other way.
Thanks, Michelle, for your question. We do have to take another break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions for Lisa Feldman Barrett. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Lamy Wellahan Shoes, helping people in Maine communities through their shoe donation program, gathering and distributing over 10,000 pairs of shoes to Mainers in need.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate: has the special U.S.-Saudi relationship outlived its usefulness?
Saudi Arabia is a pressure cooker, and one day it's going to implode.
The Middle East is in flames right now. I think it would be a profound mistake for us to experiment with this relationship.
Join us in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, coming up in 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
A spoken poem makes a momentary community between speaker and listener. Hi, this is Stuart Kestenbaum, Maine's Poet Laureate. Join me for Poems From Here, heard weekly on Maine Public Radio after Maine Calling on Friday, or on Maine Public Classical after Robin and Toby's shows. Visit us online at mainepublic.org for our schedule and where you can hear all of our poems from here.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a new way of thinking about human emotions and where they come from. Joining me, Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a leader in the study of human emotions a university distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University, and the author of a new book called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Going up to Caribou and Larry. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Dr. Barrett, I'm on a CBC, that's a Canadian broadcasting website, and the title of the show was Scientists Research Man Missing 90% of His Brain Who Leads a Normal Life. So my first question is, I don't believe that the brain, and I'm not alone, creates consciousness, nor do I believe that it creates the emotions either, just as you say. And I'm wondering if there's not a more of a biological basis to emotions and feelings, and that the brain is simply there to monitor these emotions and acting like some sort of receptor, transmitter, switching device. But the main thing is, here's a fellow, 90% of his brain missing, hydrocephalus, leads a normal life.
Dr. Barrett, are you familiar with that study, that person?
I'm not familiar with that person. I am familiar, though, with some concepts that Larry might find interesting. One is there are many debates about, you know, where in the nervous system consciousness arises. This is a bigger debate than we probably have time to discuss on this show, or actually even in, you know, people have been debating it for decades. I think that one important thing to understand is really one of the things that the brain is doing, you know, we sort of assume that the brain is for thinking or feeling or what have you. Maybe Larry is more skeptical of this. But actually, you know, the reason why you have a brain is not to be conscious, but to control your body, the systems of your body. So in much the same way, like a large company has a financial office that parses its revenues and keeps track of its expenses across various accounts, you have a financial office, too, for your body. That's what your brain does, basically. So while your brain, in fact, is creating, you know, doing whatever it does, it's also managing the budget for all of the accounts in your body, the systems for glucose, which is a simple sugar that your cells use, for energy, salt, water, and so on and so forth. And the basis of your most basic feelings come from the sensory changes in your body. This is not only represented in the cortex, it's represented in all the way through your brain, the subcortical regions of your brain. So some scientists want to argue that, for example, there are people, for example, who have very basic sort of elemental conscious feelings of pleasantness and unpleasantness, and they don't have a cortex. They primarily are without one. And as is often the case with very, very, very severe cases of hydrocephaly, that most of the cortex is damaged. So there are people we do have the capacity to have very simple feelings just with subcortical regions of the brain. That being said, there's this really fascinating concept in biology called degeneracy. It's a horrible name, but the idea is that your brain doesn't have just one way to to control any action or to make any experience, any perception or so on. It has multiple ways. So every biological system that has ever been studied has the property of degeneracy. Genes do, for example. So when you one of the reasons why we have characteristics that are highly heritable but no one can figure out what the genes are is that it's not just that there are 200 genes participating in making, you know, a particular characteristic. It's that it's different genes in different people can make the same characteristic. And so there's a lot of redundancy and degeneracy in a human brain. So it doesn't surprise me to know that that someone can lose a lot of brain tissue. 90%, though, that's a lot. I mean, I'll be interested to go and look up this case. But there are lots of cases, for example, the so-called Broca's area, which people for thought for a century was where language was computed. Many people have damage to Broca's area and have no problems with language, and that's because language has degenerate systems in the brain.
Larry, thanks for your call. Going to Orono and Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much, Dr. Feldman. Your work is very interesting and multifaceted. I could ask a question about every caller's topic, but my history is as a painter and a teacher of foreign language. I'm interested in the change in the students from when I got out of college to now, and you know, I don't want to demonize technology. I just really don't believe that. I'm like thinking the human brain is adapting. We just don't know how or where or what. And I can feel like a dinosaur some days, but that's not the point. My point is, I have a basic question about the human brain. If 85%, supposedly, this is what I read, of human communication happens non-linguistically, so through body languages or gestures or facial expressions, how is that possibly changing with students that are hanging out together and each looking at a screen and not even... Like, they're not, they're, it's almost like a new language is, I'm having to learn a new language to even interact with kids around technology. And because of the inferiority complex that schools have towards, you know, getting our kids technologically savvy, they're allowed to have a laptop and a computer and a phone. It, you know, they're tech heavy in the schools. So I just want to know, you know, in your opinion, is there something that we need to protect? I want to contrast the image of students hanging out after school with technology and not even interacting with a picture of a chimp who was an orphan and taken care of and healed and lives peacefully on an island in Borneo. And anyway, a caregiver, when he was a baby, came back to visit him at 18 years later. And there was a lot of reading of body language. It was like, is this person safe? Do I know this person? Oh, yes, I know this person. And then the chimp broke into a huge smile. And it made me sob because I don't see kids responding to other kids.
Okay, Sarah, I'm going to give Lisa a chance to respond. Go ahead.
So I'm right there with you, Sarah. Here's what I'll say. It is the case that much communication that occurs between people is nonverbal. When you put two people in a room and they're talking to each other, so for example, even though you and I don't know each other, if we were in a room, if we'll say we met in a coffee shop and we started to talk, a lot of our communication would happen nonverbally. There's tremendous context, though. So when you're looking at my face, you can also hear my voice and you can see my body posture, but also we would be in a particular situation that where there's a lot of rich context, which helps us disambiguate and make meaning of, like, what does that, you know, what does that furrowed brow mean? Is it anger? Is it confusion? Are you squinting in order to see something like me, you know, because I my eyesight's not so good when my glasses are off? And also we communicate nonverbally by with synchrony. So when you put two humans together and they like each other and they're communicating well, they're heart rates synchronize, their breathing rates synchronize, they start to move in similar ways. This is the way that we regulate each other's nervous systems. We're social species. That's part of what we do. So what's interesting is that when you interact with people over social media or you do parallel play, you know, you're on your phone and the person beside you is on their phone, or sometimes, you know, when you're at a restaurant, it's like you two people who are at dinner with each other, but they're both on their phones. What you see, there's a loss of context. That's why emojis and emoticons were invented, right, to try to give context, emotional context to words, in order to make them more meaningful. The irony, of course, is that even emojis themselves are ambiguous when you just show them on their own and without the words. So the point is that all these signals that we have, that information that we exchange when we're interacting, all has to be interpreted with context, in the context of each other. When you start to pick away at different pieces, the signal becomes impoverished and it becomes ambiguous and becomes, frankly, stressful for people. That being said, you know, we have brains that wire themselves to their circumstances. So it may be that we will discover other ways that we learn to coordinate ourselves with each other and communicate in this technology-rich environment. I think it's an opportunity for us to learn something about how humans interact with each other.
Sarah, thanks so much for your call. Lisa Feldman Barrett, I want to end by asking you a question that I think a lot of people have. And your chapter 9 is Mastering Your Emotions. And I guess my question is, now that you've learned all this about our brain, what kind of advice do you have for all of us to lead a more, I'm going to leave it blank, a more blissful, a more content, a more a life in which we've mastered our emotions?
I make a couple of recommendations in the chapter. I'll only cover one or two here. The first thing I would say is, you know, the experiences that you have today become the predictions that your brain uses tomorrow. So if you invest some effort in cultivating, in curating new experiences for yourself today, in being curious about your own surroundings and being curious about other people, this gives you new experiences that your brain can use pretty automatically and pretty efficiently in the future. So one thing you can do is just explore and be curious. Learn new emotion words. There's a big emphasis right now on emotion concepts that are untranslatable in English, which just means there's not a one-to-one pairing. You know, Schadenfreude is a good example. Now it's a single concept in our culture, but in the past, this was something that was untranslatable. And we, you know, our brains have this amazing capacity to do what we call, scientists call, conceptual combination. That is, it can take two concepts that we think of as separate and put them together to make a new one. And it can do it really, really efficiently, and it can actually broaden your experience. So that's one major thing that you can do, and that will help you control your brain, help your brain control your body better when you're in a range of situations. The other thing that I suggest to people, which, you know, sounds like I'm being a mother instead of a neuroscientist, and I guess I'm both, so is, you know, make sure you get enough sleep. Make sure you're eating well. Make sure you exercise. Make sure that you take breaks from social media. These are the things, the ambiguity of social media, the lack of sleep and so on, these things throw your body's budget out of balance and make it more likely that you will experience distress. And when you experience distress, much of the time, you don't experience that distress as a physical, with a physical cause. You will experience it as an emotion. Sometimes we even experience it as a perception. You know, that guy's an, that's a horrible, you know, this tastes horrible. I don't like this person. I don't trust this person.
Oh my gosh, you Lisa, know, I have got to say thank you. We're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us today. Lisa Feldman Barrett, University Diggs Distinguished Professor of Psychology at Northeastern. Her new book is How Emotions Are Made. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio. Lisa Feldman Barrett is the University Distinguished Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University. She's also with Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Her newest book just came out. It's called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. This show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about the growing role of women in Maine's burgeoning beer industry. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.